seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner. I've caddied for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello, Golf Weekly listeners. You're very welcome along as ever. Something a bit different for you today, friends of the pod. For our international listeners, today is a pod dedicated to one of Ireland's golfing greats. For Irish listeners, we can simply say today's pod is about himself. Christy O'Connor Sr., born in Galway in 1924, became one of the leading golfers on the European circuit from the mid-1950s. In his obituary in The Guardian, Christy was described as, quote, one of Europe's most recognisable sportsmen of the 1950s, 60s and 70s. So Christy won 24 European titles, as the European Tour was then. He played in 10 successive Ryder Cups from 1955 through to 1973, partnering, amongst others, Peter Alliss to much acclaim, and he was part of the famous win in 1957.
Christian O'Connor drives all for Britain in the final day of the Ryder Cup match. Up against men like America's Ed Fergal, even if all their putts don't come off, nobody gives the British team under skipper Di Reece much of a chance. After all, it's 24 years since we won the Ryder Cup, and Britain, or more correctly, Great Britain and Era, start the singles 3-1 down. Here's America's Doug Ford. But American skipper Jackie Burke and his team, normally brilliant golfers, find the pace too hot, while the British players, including Burke's opponent Peter Mills in his first ever Ryder Cup match, are playing like champions. Hole by hole, the pattern of victory emerges. One by one, all the other Britons force their way into the lead. At the 12th green, Di Reece sinks his last putt to beat Ed Fergal 7-up and 6 to play. The crowd scrambles for a ball that deserves to be in a glass case on somebody's mantelpiece. A souvenir of an historic day when by 7.5 points to 4.5, Di Reece and his merry men put an end to nearly a quarter of a century of defeat. Says Di, it must be the greatest shot in the arm British golf has ever had.
Christy played in the Open 26 times. He finished in the top 10 times, including in 1965 at Royal Birkdale, when he finished second behind the great Peter Thomson, who won his fifth Open that year.
Royal Birkdale 1965, and Christy O'Connor of Ireland strides down the fairway with Kel Nagle, one shot off the lead, held by Peter Thomson of Australia. A birdie at the last to set a clubhouse lead of 287 for the hugely talented Irishman.
And naturally, he dominated the Irish golfing scene. Famously, in the 1966 Carroll's International at his beloved Royal Dublin, Christy finished 2 on 16, 3 on 17, 3 on 18. That is eagle, birdie, eagle finish to win the tournament by 2 strokes. There's a plaque on the 16th tee at Royal Dublin to mark the achievement. O'Connor was elected to the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2009, a huge honour, just the second Irishman after Joe Carter received the honour. Here's his acceptance speech, recorded at Royal Dublin, where Christy, of course, was the club professional for 50 years. His World Golf Hall of Fame acceptance speech in 2009.
George O'Grady rang me from London, and I thought at the moment that somebody was playing a big joke on me. It didn't dawn to me for a moment that I was good enough to have that honour, which was one of the great honours in the world. A few days afterwards, Jack Peters came along. He said, I'm over here to invite you into the Hall of Fame. So I said, well, now it's not a joke. I know this is quite all right. I would like to thank all these people who voted for me. I would like also to thank all the people who have got in touch with me since this was announced. A matter of fact, I've been walking on air since this has happened. It's been a great thrill for me to have this at my age now, 22 and a bit. I think that maybe I would have liked if I had got it a little earlier. But the point of fact is this is good as any time. Golf has been very good to me. I had opportunities that I've wouldn't have got in anything else. I've travelled a good part of the world on several occasions playing golf. This alone was a great experience to meet other people, to see how they behaved, how they played golf, and I enjoyed it, I must say. I was so lucky in my life. I had good health up to a certain time of my life. I was very strong. I kept myself very fit. Of course, if you're giving 36 holes a day and then giving 6 or 7 lessons a day at the same time, that does keep you fit. I'm very sad that I can't be in the States because I would love to be there. There is a lot of friends who will be disappointed that I'm not there. But then again, health is something that you have got to look after. I don't want to go to some place and feel that I've left myself down or leave the people who would be good enough to have me there to let them down. That would be the worst thing for me in the world. So, friends, I'm so sad that I can't be with you. I hope that everybody and all my friends there will have a magnificent time. And the ones that's coming in to get the honor that I'm receiving, I wish them great health, great golf, and long life.
Christy passed away aged 91. Back in 2016. And a few weeks ago, frankly, we got an invitation we couldn't refuse. Christy's grandson, Connor Darcy, is a friend of the pod, and he got in touch and he said, lads, why don't you come out to Royal Dublin, play a round of golf with some of his family, record a chat afterwards, we'll invite some of his friends who played with him as well, and you can put whatever you want out in the pod. So we could hardly refuse that. So back in June, Nathan was away, but back in June, myself and Fionn went out to Royal Dublin and Bull Island, which is just fantastic course. If you haven't been there, you really should make it and get it onto your bucket list and take that off whenever you get the chance. It's fantastic views and just a brilliant course as well. So we had a great day. I mean, it's been the summer to end all summers weather-wise in Ireland, and we got a really brilliant day that day as well. So we'll bring you some of the thoughts to come shortly from friends and from family. We played with Christy Jr., his son, and we played with Connor. But first, we also invited out Dermot Galise from the Sunday Independent to join us. Dermot lives nearby in Clontarf, and we figured, well, if anyone knows Christy from a journalistic point of view, it is Dermot Galise. So we started with Dermot, and he was his usual excellent self.
Good to be here, Joe.
This is a very nice golf course. We've learned that this afternoon, even though we didn't play it very well.
It's a common complaint.
It's a beautiful course, though, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah, yeah. They did a terrific job on it, and they always keep it in very good condition. You know, the greens particularly are a delight to play.
Christy O'Connor Sr., when I think of him, I don't have much footage to go on, but on the limited footage I've seen, what's so striking is that there's a rhythm about the swing, which is quite beautiful. And he did not like people saying that it came naturally to him.
No, it's for the simple reason that it didn't come naturally to him. I mean, he was professionally taught. He learned from his caddying days at Galway Golf Club. He learned from Bob Wallace, who was a very accomplished teacher. And Bob obviously taught him well, and Christy obviously listened well. Mm. But the real foundation work was done in Bundoran when he was professional there. That would have been around 1950 to 53 or 54. And he used to work there assiduously on the beach at Bundoran, hitting shots day in, day out, hail, rain or whatever. And he talked about that. And that's why he resented the notion that he was a natural player.
Because I was reading, there were many obituaries about him, obviously, 2 years ago. And in one of them, it said, O'Connor pointed out that in his early days he was lightning fast, that was his phrase, lightning fast and too upright, and that his rhythm had developed only after years of intense practice. That was his version. How good was he then? It's difficult for us and younger listeners to put his career into context, given that he was pre-European tour, given that the world was so different. So how good are we talking over? What period are we talking about?
Well, you're talking about Christy, obviously, from the early 50s until the mid-70s. And then He had a terrific senior career. I mean, he won six British senior A, senior PGA titles, and he won two world titles. His longevity was clearly a feature of his game. But I think if you were to look at him seriously, I think the best assessment I ever read of Christy was from a contemporary, Peter Alice, who said that Christy had everything except the putt. Mm. And I think it was generally conceded that he was a pretty ordinary putter, certainly in comparison to the rest of his game, which was quite outstanding. I mean, people like Gary Player talked about O'Connor as having a wonderful swing, something that they copied as best they could. Tony Jacklin talked about his tempo. Funnily enough, Jacklin used to talk about this little piccolo grip whereby Christy let the fingers of his right hand become quite loose at the top of the backswing. And Jacklin reckoned that he sacrificed a certain amount of control by doing that. But I suppose what it did for Christy was that it emphasised the relaxed nature of the swing from his own standpoint, you know, that... he would never have been accused of gripping the club too tightly, and that's for sure. Mm.
Dermot, for someone who was so meticulous in his analysis and construction of his own golf swing, and who's clearly worked so hard to get the swing the way he wanted it, it must have frustrated him no end that he couldn't bring his putting up to par with the rest of his golf game.
Yeah, well, it was a common complaint then, Fiona, and it probably still is now. I mean, we have Rory McIlroy railing against his putting at the moment. The comparison, the gap between Christie's long game and his putting was probably similar to what Rory's going through now.
So but he's still a very good putter. He just wasn't an elite putter.
Harry Bradshaw, who was a great friend of his, and they played a lot together. Harry told me, like, that Christy had a great facility to sink long putts. I mean, he was liable to sink them from 25, 30 feet, and he would miss short ones. But by and large, the Brad reckoned that Christy factored in that he was going to miss about four or five or even six holdable putts in the course of any round. But as against that, he used to chip in on a regular basis. And he sank, as I say, a lot of long putts.
Isn't that the mark of of the unmentionables, is that generally putters who struggle with the yips can put long putts. They can make great long putts. It's the little short ones that kill you.
Yeah, well, I don't think Christy was ever yippy in that regard. But technique was definitely suspect. No, it was a different type of putting in those days than we have now. I mean, the greens were running at about half the speed of that they are now, which meant that the actual putting action, rather than a pendulum flowing type of stroke, was a wrapping stroke whereby you banged the ball to get it up to the hole even, you know.
I think it might have been Peter Alice who described it as this rounded putting stroke that was forever fragile.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it, excuse the pun.
Wristy Christy was the nickname. So if you were to talk about his style, he clipped the ball off the turf. He wasn't taking big divots. Is that, I mean, most people listening haven't really seen much of him or don't have a feel for him as a player, but he would pick the ball, I've read.
The best I've ever seen of O'Connor as a ball striker, funny enough, it was in the twilight, certainly in the autumn of his career. It was down in Mount Juliet in July 1991 when he and Jack Nicklaus gave a clinic prior to playing for the opening day of the Mount Juliet golf course. Mm. And they were on the practice ground hitting shots, and Nicklaus was talking about fading the ball and drawing the ball. And he was explaining, and everything that Nicklaus said and explained was a technical change. It required a technical adjustment. In other words, I stand closed if I want to hit a hook, and I stand open if I want to hit a draw, and I move the ball back and I open the blade slightly. Christy said none of that. He just hit the ball. So I'm looking at Christy and he's hitting drivers off a tee, and then he starts hitting drivers off a deck. And then he taps the ball down with the club head into the softish turf and begins to hit these half submerged shots, which are going out there at about 3 or 4 feet height off the ground. Yeah. And I even saw Nicholas looking at him, as much as to say, what in the name of Jesus is going on here, you know? I mean, Nicholas was just gobsmacked by the quality of what he was observing. He had a forward, which, as they say, he could make talk. Now, he used to use that even out of bunkers. I mean, I remember Joe Craddock telling me they were playing in Woodbrook, and the famous, I think it was the seventh hole, isn't it? The index one. It's a dogleg right around the corner, and there's a bunker at the apex of the dogleg, and it's there specifically to catch drives. Now, for Craddock, it was a 7-iron shot out of the bunker to the green. And Christy was in the same bunker beside him, and he hits a 4-wood. Wow. Again, the wristy action that he had, he could flip the ball with his wrist, and the club he had in his hand really didn't matter. Because it was, you talk about players, players nowadays will tell you that they've lost control of the club head of the golf ball, and that's how their game like just evaporated, as it were. That never happened to Christy. He was the antithesis of that. He always had absolute control over the club head and the golf ball.
Yeah, and so following on from that then, it's difficult again for us to understand how highly we should regard the career he had because it was such a different time. Like the Guardian in their obituary of Christy said he was one of Europe's most recognisable sportsmen of the 50s, 60s and 70s. And then, you know, you read 24 European titles, 20 additional international titles, 10 Irish PGAs, every Ryder Cup for 10 years, which was a record until Faldo in 97. And then I also see, you know, the Open Championship 26 times between 51 and 79, finished second to Thompson and a whole host of top tens, but never quite got over the line. And so it's a bit like the man himself. It's not a straightforward career to digest and put into context compared to, well, Harrington is obviously a major winner, but like, a McGinley or different people. And, you know, he's in the Hall of Fame as well, which is another string to his bow. So you've got all of these things boiling away in the pot, and it's difficult to know where I have him in the pecking order.
Well, just listening to you there, Joe, you've actually outlined it very well, his whole career. And the one thing that's very obviously missing there is a major title.
He never played Augusta.
And I think that was very much, dare I say, it was very much to his cost. You know, in terms of the opinion that people might have formed of him, that he didn't give himself that chance. You know, I mean, he would have been there. The procedure at that time was that every current Ryder Cup player got an invitation to the Masters. Now, that meant that all of the British guys like Alice and Bernard Hunt and Brian Huggett, all of these guys went.
Sure.
Out of a sense of duty, I imagine, you know. Now, I talked to Christy about it, and there's no doubt. I mean, he admitted to me that he regretted not doing it.
Well, you'd have to. How could you not?
It was something he should have done.
Yeah, and now, it was because he was the pro here, and financially it was
he looked at it commercially. He looked at it strictly financially, which frankly he shouldn't have done. He should have looked at it as something that he owed himself to do, you know, because...
And he did owe himself.
He did owe himself. I mean, you have to think that the nature of Augusta National... Now, he would have had trouble on the greens, there's no doubt. But, I mean, it's an iron player's golf course, and you could imagine Christy like... moving the ball, working the ball around that place.
The imagination.
The imagination that he had for hitting golf shots. Now, I talked to Harry Bradshaw, was probably best qualified to judge Christy at the highest level. And he had the impression that Christy was afraid to win the Open. And I said, you mean like choking? And he said, not at all. No, I don't mean it like that. But he said he was afraid of what the winning the Open might do to him as a person. That Christy loved his life here, and he loved his life playing in these islands. But he never saw himself as an international player in the real sense, the same way as people like Locke and Peter Thompson and fellows like that did who travelled the world. Mm. Gary Player was the first truly international player. Vincenzo was very much an international player. And Christy was a contemporary of these guys, certainly a contemporary of Vincenzo, but he never saw himself as an... That's probably would explain why he didn't see the necessity to play the Masters. You know, if you could get away with not playing it, why not?
Mm.
And the Brad felt that when the opportunities came, and they did come to win the Open Championship, that in the back of his mind, he sort of half pulled back. Because if he became Open champion, there were an awful lot of things he would have had to do. He would have had to change his life. I mean, he would have seen in a smaller way, it happened to Fred Daly, who won, as we know, in 47. And that the sort of career that Christy had mapped out for himself would have changed dramatically.
Because he was a home bird as well?
Yes, yeah. He was very much a home bird.
And is that why he... Because he didn't play the Masters, but he also never played the US Open
I think
or the USPGA.
He went to qualify once for the US Open and didn't actually make the field. He never played in the PGA.
In defence of Christie's view at the time...
Well, sorry, Fionn, yeah. You raised an interesting point in defence. Sorry, I just wanted to finish what I was about to say. That I think it's necessary to probe this, you know, because it's not as simple as saying that he wasn't good enough, because he clearly was good enough. I mean, right. Peter Thompson reckoned that if he had won one Open, he'd have won a half a dozen.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, you know, he said that. Thompson said if he won one, he would have won several.
That's amazing.
Because his whole thinking would have changed. And there was never any suggestion that he didn't have the fortitude to do it. People talked about he didn't have, maybe the putter let him down or he didn't get the breaks or stuff like that. Let's be honest, Christy had enough opportunities to win the Open. He was close enough, often enough, to have won it. There had to be more to it than that. And I tend to buy in to the Brad's thinking that deep down there was something about it that he created a sort of a mental block himself.
Can I just ask, though, because I know there's...
I'm sorry if you want to have cut
across. Not at all.
There's always a danger. I mean, it's part of the joy of sport is almost trying to psychoanalyze people.
Yeah.
What did he ever say to you, because you would have spoken to him down the years, about not winning the Open? Was it up there with... You mentioned he said Augusta was maybe a regret. Did he ever say to you, God, I really regret I didn't win the Open?
Well, of course, we did discuss the Open, and he said, to be honest with you, now he may have been mitigating the thing from his own perspective,
sure.
But he said, to be honest with you, he said, I never saw it as anything more than a pension. I was only afterwards, when it was all gone, as it were, that I realised the importance that people placed on it.
Mm.
Now,
is that potentially true? Because the majors seem to have grown in importance.
Well, that's true, yeah.
Like
but
Jack
I mean,
Nicklaus didn't
but
see
he
them.
Would have known.
Yeah.
I mean, from his exposure to golf club manufacturers and people like that, even at that time, I mean, Open Champion was a particular, it was a signal honour, I mean, to be Open Champion. Fred Daly would have been, as I say, would have made a lot of us, a lot of his contemporaries aware of the importance of being Open Champion. Now, there certainly wouldn't have been anything like the money in endorsements and stuff like that at that time that there are now. But there still would have been considerable kudos in being an Open Champion.
Sure.
So should not diminish that in any way.
Because I think perhaps, and just for the sake of looking at the other side of the argument, there's the risk of judging the decision to forsake, say, Augusta with the bias of today. Like, when I was reading about Christy, I also found out that Lee Trevino refused an invitation to Augusta for 4 straight years because he thought it was all... He didn't like the way Augusta was set up, or he had an issue with Augusta at the time.
It was a racial thing.
So I suppose, whereas nowadays, you can't imagine a top golfer turning down an invite to Augusta. So,
oh no, you're right, Fionn. There were very different times.
So is there a sense that in the 50s and 60s, of course it was a prestigious invitational event, but it was a prestigious invitational event. It wasn't what it is today.
although that's perfectly true. I mean, just a brief observation on Augusta and how it developed. I mean, in the 60s, it was still just a tournament. Mm. And, for instance, to try and promote it on this side of the pond, Augusta National used to wrote directly to the leading golf writers in Fleet Street of the time, people like Peter Ride of the Times and Pat Ward Thomas of the Guardian, guys like that. And they invited them, get yourself to New York and we look after you from there. In other words, if a fellow could get the boat or a flight to New York, they would be picked up, taken to Augusta, put up for the week, the whole thing, because Augusta were extremely anxious to promote their event. Now, they wouldn't be doing that if it was in everybody's lips. It clearly wasn't. So you're right. It wasn't as important to Christie then as it would be now. But at the same time, it was still an important tournament.
Can I put a quote here from Peter Dobereiner?
Yeah.
People see O'Connor differently. To some, he's a quiet, shy man. To some, he's a hell-raising extrovert, eager for a fistfight. To some, a moody bore. To some, a warm, witty companion. There are as many O'Connors as there are people who think they know him. Discuss.
Discuss. Well, I wouldn't buy into that, to be honest with you. Anytime Christie drank, he tended to... let's put it this way. He was a bad subject for drink. He'd have been better off if he just had the odd pint and left it there. So there were arguments that arose in drink. But I would never have seen him as somebody, for instance, who had a drink problem. I mean, it would be ludicrous and very wrong to suggest that it impeded his success, his further success in any way. I don't believe it did.
I'm glad you've said that, because I've often thought that's been politely intimated.
No. Yeah. No, well, I knew him, and I would never have seen that. Mm. But what I did see was that he was a social animal. He was a man of his time. And it was a different time, Joe. Things were a lot more relaxed. I mean, there was a lovely story told of Christie when you can imagine the number of times that people tried to get the keys of his car off him in this very building. And there was one particular occasion he had, I gather it was a nice new Peugeot he had, and anyway, somebody prevailed upon him. They felt he maybe had won over the eight, and they got the keys of the car off him, and the guy who was driving him home went out that gate out there, misjudged the exit and ripped the left hand side off Christie's car, and Christie's sitting in the passenger seat, and he turns to him and said, "I could have done that myself."
So the sense of humour.
He clearly had.
Your friend and ours, Dermot, Paul Ferreter, who sculpted Christie for the Oceanico group down in Portugal, told me a lovely story that when he was spending time with Christie ahead of the sculpture, he was over in his house with himself and Mary, his wife, and he kind of whispered to him, or he looks at Paul and he says, "Listen, all those stories about me, most of them aren't true." And then Mary says, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And he says, yeah, "I'd love a cup of tea." And then Mary says, "Would you like a drop of something in it?" And with this mischievous look, he looks at Paul and then looks back at Mary and goes, "I'll have a drop of milk." And obviously he's playing into that, you know, the Hellraiser, the guy. And you know, there's the famous story that's told about him where he tees off a tournament, but he hits one left into the woods because the guy's waiting for him with a pot of coffee.
That is true.
Is that actually true?
That happened at the World Cup in Paris. That is absolutely true.
Because the guy who brought out the coffee said it was he told him, go to the 250-yard marker 65 left. He said the ball landed nearly on me. It was the greatest shot I've ever seen.
Oh, no, that is true. That's a true story. That happened in the World Cup in Paris. I think it was 1965,
I read that yesterday.
Yeah, no, that is perfectly true.
He had a hangover, wanted the coffee, and it was in the first tee, and they said, you can't bring coffee to the first tee, it looked bad. He said, right, 200 up, 65 left, and he dropped the ball in the trees. I read that, and I thought, well, this is exactly the kind of unfair myths about Christie O'Connor that are going on.
All right, well, I'll give you another unfair myth, which I actually witnessed. And it was when the Carroll's match play was played in County Sligo in 1973, I think it was. And let me put it this way, he and I burnt the midnight oil together.
Right.
And we went over to the Eighth Country Hotel at about 7 to finish up the night. Whereupon Christy said to me, Jesus, I'm on the tee in about an hour. He said, I'd better clean myself up. And he left me and he disappeared, went up to the bathroom, rub-a-dub-dub, shaved the whole lot. Was on the tee, if I'm not mistaken, at about 8:15 and shot 67.
Ah, stop.
In howling winds.
That's just
like
pure
when he'd no right to do that for 9 holes even.
So the talent was phenomenal then.
The talent was phenomenal. Now, like, you see, if you want to discuss serious drinking or drinking problem drinking, all you have to do is look at Christie's career. I mean, look how long it lasted.
Yeah.
He couldn't possibly have done what he was doing into his 50s and 60s. I mean, I'll put this to you. At 48 years of age, he did something that if it had happened nowadays, we'd be raving about it. I know Tom Watson in Turnberry in 09 was an astonishing achievement. But in 1973, Christie was 48 years of age and finished 7th in the Open at Troon behind Tom Weisskopf and could have won it at 48. Mm. Now, you don't do that
unless,
if you're a martyr to the booze, no, as they say and here.
Yeah, I don't think I.
So I think there's an awful lot of nonsense.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you've said that. And so to begin to wrap this up, in his later years around here, I mean, you briefly mentioned it when we were having a sandwich outside that, for instance, the way he played the 18th changed over the years, but demonstrated the technical proficiency of the man.
The enduring skill, it was astonishing.
So 18 in his heyday, he'd get home in two. He'd get home in two either way, you might explain. It's a tough hole here.
Yeah, he used to. Noel Fox told me this, that he actually played with Christie in a, it was a pro-am event here. No, it was one of Cecil Whelan's tournaments. A Lynx tournament, Lynx event, that's what it was. But like Christie, as I say, the 18th, it has various incarnations as a long par 4, a par 5, and a par 4 as it is now. But Christie would always aim at getting home in 2, and it was generally a drive and a mid iron, 6 iron for him. But Noel saw him playing on this occasion, and he was well into his 70s at the time. And his thinking was still the same in terms of getting home in 2, except that it was 2 drivers he hit. I mean, he hit a driver on off the deck over the garden. I mean, as accurately and as sweetly as any mid-iron he ever hit. Mm. And that was a measure of his enduring skill, you know, that the great ones. Joe Carr used to say, like, that swingers linger.
Yes.
And Joe Christie was definitely a swinger.
We only have 2 players in the World Hall of Golf Hall of Fame. One obviously is Joe Carr and the other is Christie. Did he feel underappreciated in his own time, do you think? And is he?
No, I don't think so. I mean, actually that Hall of Fame situation is amazing. I mean, I was with him. I was with him on the actual day he got the word that he was inducted into the World Hall of Fame. Now,
was he expecting it?
He wasn't expecting it, and he didn't tell me what it was. He said, something big is happening today. He said, I can't tell you what it is, but trust me, it's really big.
Yeah.
And as it happened, that very same day, Nicholas was down in Killeen Castle putting the final touches to some work he was doing down there. And I went down there to meet him, and I told him Christie had been inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he said, which one? And I said, the one. He says, oh, he said, gee, that's great, he said. Nobody deserved it more. I'm delighted for him.
Great.
And that was the same month, actually, that Shane Lowry won the Irish Open at Baltrae. But Christie was genuinely chuffed to bits. The other thing was that he was invariably highly respectful of his contemporaries.
Yeah.
I never heard him denigrate or downplay the achievements or the skill of any of his contemporaries.
Is that right?
Never.
Right.
If he didn't think very much of an individual, he just didn't talk about him.
Well, that's the mark of a man.
Yeah. But he, an old school etiquette.
Oh,
isn't
yeah.
It?
I mean, Henry Cotton, now, he admired enormously.
So he wasn't sitting here around the clubhouse.
That fella.
Saying,
he's no, no, good
no, yeah, man. You know the way people. It's a sad trick that people have, is that they bring down others to make themselves look better. Christie never did that.
That's a classy touch. Well, let's finish then on. Let's extend that positive. There is a reason that we're still sitting here talking about him as we let you go. Yeah. If you're lucky enough to be famous, very famous, you might be known by your first name. I mean, he was known by himself, which is a whole other level of fame.
Yeah.
So his place in Irish golf and his legacy in Irish golf. Oh,
he has definitely a unique place in Irish golf. In that, I think he taught the current generation how the game should be played. You ask Padraig Harrington, and Harrington will tell you of a particular occasion in the middle of winter. It was January, I think it was, and Harrington came down here sort of as a pilgrimage, as a young aspiring professional golfer came down here and had a look around, and it was a day you wouldn't put a milk bottle out. And there on the practice ground, hitting six irons, crosswind, with the wind, against the wind, turning them this way and that, was Christie. And Harrington told me he stood there and he looked awestruck at this player. Not only because of the fact that he was actually out there in those conditions, but for the quality of the golf shots he was hitting. And Christie, at the time, would have been well into his autumn years.
We'll continue to read the Sunday Independent and your work in it. Dermot Gleeson, thank you.
Thank you.
Dermot Gleeson there of the Sunday Independent. Next up, we spoke to Christie's nephew and son. So Christie Jr. and nephew Joe Enright joined us. Joe caddied for Christie in his later playing days at 8 Irish Opens as well. Fionn and I that afternoon had played with Christie Jr., who had put together some beautiful golf on an injured leg as well, injured foot. And he's still very much hoping to make his mark at a serious level of the game. And we put it to Christie Jr. firstly that, given that he's playing golf so seriously and that his brother Peter is working in golf as well, clearly Christie Sr. had encouraged their love of golf as children.
Totally, without a doubt. Sure. He wanted one of us, or the two of us, in the game and try and be as successful as we could. Sadly, so far we haven't got it at the playing side of it, but I'm trying hard and I keep aiming to succeed, and please God, I will succeed. But Peter is in the teaching side of it, and he's very successful down in Portugal.
Because there was a sense, I wonder, and just speaking to other people who knew him, that he was a very generous teacher. Was he, when you were young, I mean, did he appreciate that he had this talent that isn't bestowed on everyone, maybe including his own kids, and as good as you guys could become, that he understood that, like, well, not everyone's going to do it the way I do it?
Yeah, totally. Like, no, geez, he was the fairest man. What he wanted was people to succeed and try and be as good as they possibly can. But he would never, like, he'd never pressurise anyone into it. He says, come on, just try it, you know, for the members, for everyone, for grandkids, for everyone. Just come on, get out there and try it now. And if you hit a bad shot, try it again and maybe do this a little bit more. But it was just fixing the grip a little bit of that. It was never ever technical with him. But what he succeeded in from where he came was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of people say, natural. And that used to drive him mad, because he spent so many hours hitting shots, whether it was in Bundoran, beforehand in Galway and Tuam, down in Killarney, and especially down here at his second home, Royal Dublin Golf Club.
Yeah. And he would go to Dollymount Beach and practice there as well?
He would go down to Dollymount Beach and hit balls off the sand, the hard sand. He had his own gym. I turned around to him there not too long ago, you know, before he died, God rest his soul. And I says, Dad, you were the first to start the fitness regime. And he looked at me and says, what? And I says, no, I'm telling you, you were the first to start the fitness regime. He says, what do you mean? I says, you were going up and down those sand dunes with us when we were kids, and we were walking up and down, up and down. And you said that was for your legs. Yeah, that's right. And then you go out and you take a big heavy wedge that you had, and you were hitting sand dunes up and down, up and down, up and down. He says, that was your forearms. He went, yeah. And he says, I remember the iron bar that you had at home, that you lifted in one hand up down the exercises and then the other hand up down the exercises. I says, that's the same as going to a gym now that these fellas are doing, except you're not killing yourself. Mm. And he looked at me and he thought for a second and he just smiled and he just raised a little glass of red wine. There.
Yeah. Here's a kind of, it's an unfair question to ask in a way, but actually you're a better place than most of us to answer it. So you would have seen him hit all these balls, and we've seen you play today. You know your way around the golf course, that much is very clear. So how good was he? How good was his swing? I mean, like, you must have seen him, you must have seen him hit unbelievable shots or do unbelievable things on a course. I know you would have been young maybe and not at tournaments when he was in his heyday, but even just around here in a friendly game. I presume you played lots of rounds together as you got older.
Totally.
So
yeah.
I looked for footage. I haven't seen much of him. I don't have a feel for how he would have made his way around Royal Dublin today.
Right. And this is strictly from a golf point of view.
Yeah.
It's not a father, you know, a son-father thing or anything like that. He's the best striker of golf ball I've ever seen in my life. He could do things with a golf ball that people will never be able to do, and they're making millions of pounds now out on tours. Mm. He was an exceptional iron player. He could do anything with a wood off a tee or off the deck. He was renowned for it. He could hit three woods out of bunkers or drivers out of bunkers where people were looking saying, that's impossible. No, it wasn't for him. Chipping bunker play, brilliant. People said he was a weak putter or a bad putter. As he would say, bull-ess. He wasn't. He was a streaky putter.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have won half the tournaments that he won. And it's up. People have a look at his record. It's a record that will never be beaten in Ireland. Mm. And I maintain that.
And when you're going around with him and he's, you know, maybe he's having one of those days where he's shooting a 64 or 65 and making it look easy. Did you, and you talk about people making all that money now. Would you ever kind of remark to him, God, you were born a couple of decades too late, Dad? Or did he, I mean, and would he kind of acknowledge, yeah, maybe?
No, look, it's a great question because I always wanted to ask him. And I asked him, I says, Dad, you see it now and you see the way the tour's going now and the money and, you know, would you like to, you know, play now? He says, one thing, yeah, definitely for competing in majors, it would have given him a chance now to play in every major.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe it wouldn't have been one or two that he would have won. There would have been a fair few.
Mm.
And at the time, like, you know, it was just for him, it just wasn't possible. It's that's the only regret, but he loved playing in the time that he played.
Yeah.
And he said, he wouldn't change anything, just to get the opportunity to play in more majors. That was the only thing.
He wasn't consumed by it. It didn't dominate his thinking later on in life. He was happy with his success.
No, oh Jesus, yeah. I'm very, very, very proud. But, like, you know, he was... Also, people don't realise, he was very much a family man. And when he went away... And this is, like, this is going back, as they say, but he'd be away for 5-6 weeks. Away from his wife, Mary, who he loved dearly, and his four girls and myself and Pete, and what you call it, and he would miss us as well, like, totally, and he did. So he'd love nothing more than getting back home, and that was, you know, maybe we held him back a bit, if you could imagine him saying that.
Yeah,
you know,
but the pull of home, and he was a home
bird. He was a home man. He was a home man. Like, you can see when he came to here, like, to Royal Dublin, and look how long he stayed. He loved it here. He was close to home, but yet he was out every day.
Lived in the same three-bed semi across the way in Clontarf, is that right?
Just up the road there, quarter of a mile in Blackheath Park, and my mother's still there.
Right.
Joe, who were his favourite players?
Well, I've thought of the older players, probably Ben Hogan. Of the more recent, I think Seve would have been, I think he just...
I was just listening. I'm listening to Christy describe, like, you know, playing drivers out of bunkers, and I'm thinking, Seve's won an Irish Open on this golf course.
Yeah.
It must have been like, you know, two birds of a feather. We're going, yeah.
Probably, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, as Christy said there, I caddied for him in 8 Irish Opens. The first one was in 85 here when he was 60, so he was well past his heyday and his best.
Why did you get that job?
I was cheap. No, I tell, I always loved, we were always very close. We were a close family, and I used to always take the week off at the Irish Open. And he asked me one year, "Would you want a caddy for me?"
Right.
And I said, "I'd love to."
Yeah.
And it started then, and I caddied in 8 opens. The last one here was 85, and then we were in Port Marnock for a couple, Mount Juliet, Killarney.
And what was the level of dialogue like? Did he want to know what you thought about much?
Around here, definitely not, because I think no one could tell him anything about it down here. Normally, it was, he knew his own game so well. Now it's lasers and golf buddies and all this sort of thing. And back then there was yardage books, so it might be he tell you what he thinks it is, and do you agree? So you weren't disagreeing with that one.
Yeah.
It was now and again he might say to you, "What do you think?"
Right.
I always thought that the easiest person to caddy for is a tour pro. Because they don't hit the bad shots. You know, you're trying to caddy for someone else and they could hit a 5-iron 200 yards or 140 yards.
Yeah.
These guys hit it all the same.
You should ask Bubba Watson's caddy the same
question.
Exactly
the same thing. But, you know, Christy was saying there, like, even in his latter years, like, to see that man playing, it was one of the stories. It was one of the late 80s, and he's playing one of the par fives in Port Marnock, and the back nine was 13 or 16, and he bunkered his tee shot, and he goes down, he looks at it, and the ball's above his feet, and it's off the tee, and there's a lip, you know, it's a tough shot, and the ball's above his feet, and I'm looking at it, and he's going well in the tournament, and you know he's going to make the cut, and he gets down into the bunker and he comes out, and I just had my hand on an 8-iron thinking, you know, so said nothing, just ready to give it to him, and next thing he pulls the head off the wood, and I'm looking at this thinking, like, he's lost it, you know, and the crowd are kind of thinking he's going to hit a wood, and I'm looking at them because it's the driver, and it's the old wooden headed clubs now. This was the metal woods had just come in the late 80s, and I'm thinking, like, this is he's after losing this, you know, and he hits this driver out of the bunker, ball above his feet, over the lip, big right to left, and it lands in the fairway, and it just chases down to about 40 yards short of the green. Pitches on, he holds the putt, and we're walking to it was the 16th, I said I wasn't sure which.
Yeah.
Walking to the 17th, and he just looks at me and he just goes, 8-iron. Jeez, you know? And, like, you know, I just thought, you know, what can you say to that?
Yeah.
Because, as you said, Bubba Watson would probably do that, but I don't know many who would, you know. And it was just, and it was the way he looked at me, and he just said, like, 8-iron, and he just shook his head. And I just
How did he interact with the crowds? Like, you know the way there are some players, like your Arnie Palmers, who love chatting to the crowds, Jack Nicklaus not so much. What was Christy like?
The Irish crowds loved him.
Yeah.
I mean, they just idolised him, and he was a real home, patriotic home guy. Wouldn't really talk to them, but he was very gracious, and he'd wave and he'd smile.
Well, one of the lads, I think it was Cecil, was saying that he saw him at a tournament. He was like, "Hey, yeah," and completely ignore it.
Yes.
But then the next day he was up here and saw Cecil and he was chatting away. So actually there was tournament mode, and he was not in for waving and signing flags and signing gloves. He was there to compete.
That's his job.
That was how he treated tournament golf.
Absolutely.
It's fair enough. One of the great things is to sit here and chat to you guys. So, you know, you read about him and you have everything from Hellraiser to a shy man to temper to very funny to very kind. Like, all these adjectives about it makes him sound like such an interesting man. I'd love your thoughts on, like, the Christy that you hear about. Do people capture the man? And, like, he's such a rounded, kind of interesting figure.
Yeah, well, okay, that's an interesting one.
You made a fist there as if I've said something that's upset you.
No. It's, people had an idea of the man, but an awful lot of people, like, listen to stories that were not true.
So the drinking abuse, I think.
Totally. Like, he wouldn't have won a quarter of what he won if he had been out doing what people said he did.
Mm.
People, he might have a drink after a round, but it might have been one or two.
Mm.
But then 100 people in the bar wanted to be having that drink with Christy O'Connor.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden he had 10 or 15. He did not. He couldn't. It'd be impossible to do what he did.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Dermot Cleese made that point. That he was of his time, liked to drink, liked to party, sociable. Dermot said you couldn't have had the career he had if it was anything more than,
totally. Totally. It would have been possible. The man would have been dead by 50. You know, like, he looked after himself so well.
Mm.
He was 91 years of age when he died.
Yeah.
So that tells you something.
Yeah. You know? Would that have bothered you or bothered him that people had that sense that he was this wild?
Oh, totally.
Did it?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Oh, of course. That's the real thing that would bother anyone in the family.
Right.
Saying, oh, well, he was a hellraiser, he was this, he was that. He wasn't. He was no such thing. Okay, he was a tough man from the west of Ireland.
Yeah.
But Jesus, so what? He was out there trying to feed his family, trying to represent his country.
Mm.
And he did it better than nearly everyone.
And what was your sense of him then? So, sense of humour?
He had great devilment. Great devilment with his grandchildren, with his nephews, nieces, with everyone. He, like, once you got him at home and he was off the golf course, because golf course is a mode, it was his profession, that's what he was doing.
Mm.
But once you got him at home, and he loved people dropping in at home. We had many famous family gatherings where we had loads of friends in and that sort of stuff. You know, for his birthday on the 21st December every year, we had an awful lot of the members coming down. We had fantastic times, a real like a West of Ireland shindig. And sadly, they're missed now because he's not here. But no, but he was a very gentle. Okay, he'd had his moments, like us all.
So, would he have a temper as well? Or
no, he didn't have a temper. He just, if he felt he was right, he'd try and get that point.
Okay, so he could have an argument with you if he felt strongly about it. He was that totally. He had a bit of fire about him.
Totally, totally. Yeah. But I think that runs with the O'Connors.
Is that right?
I think so.
But, yeah, just even what you're saying there, what I loved about your dad, and like he was great fun and great development and all that, and the grandkids, and my, I have a young lad who's 16 now, who was 40 when Christy died, but like he loved Christy, and like Christy make him, he wasn't a young kid that's getting in the way, like, you know, he had the time, but everybody knew where they stood with him,
right?
You know, because he took to someone or he didn't, and if he took to you, you were his best friend forever, and that's, you know, you were close and you were part of the inner circle and that sort of thing.
And if he didn't,
and he had that. I don't know too many who weren't, but I'd say I'd say normally I think that if you weren't in, there was good reason that you weren't in, you know.
Actually,
I did read that he couldn't abide slow play, and now it's the scourge of modern golf, and we all know this.
Yeah.
But and he was a stickler for etiquette.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, because you were cursing actually out there. And Christy said,
because if my father was alive, that wouldn't be happening.
I mightn't have done that if he was in the yeah. four-pot in front.
Chris, it was interesting. Christy goes, he'd never have done that now if he knew. Christy was around.
That's true.
So he wouldn't have been one for bad language on a golf course or temper. Or
and it's you certainly wouldn't hear us outside the little four. Yeah, he might. Yeah.
Because I noticed, Christy, you have unbelievable golf etiquette. You're the first one over to search for everyone's ball. I mean, I'm a normal human being. So when Fionn loses his ball, I'm like,
Joe Malloy.
You're hoping he doesn't find it.
Joe Malloy will never help you look for a ball.
I will, grudgingly. I'm just looking. Yeah.
But Joe's actually true. And one of the things as well, and it is, I mean, clearly you learnt golf from your dad, not just the swing, but how to behave yourself on a golf course. And one of the things that struck me today was that you were raking bunkers for all of us.
Mm. So he was big on that stuff, was he, Christy?
You help your fellow golfers any way you can, and it's always, as I said, it's always nice to be nice. No need to be any other way.
Yeah.
There was always that great debate of like, oh, it's Tiger v. Jack. Did Christy come down on any side of that?
If we're going 1v1, it'll be Jack Nicklaus.
Really?
Totally.
Could you tell us a bit about his relationship with Jack? I know, I think Jack phoned here one day when he was outside giving someone a lesson. So they obviously, this was years later after they started, so they obviously had a good relationship.
No, you know, no, they did. Like, they played each other a fair bit in Ryder Cups and in tournaments in America and tournaments in Europe and that sort of thing. But it was when the World Hall of Fame
in 2009
was announced, there was a bit of a gathering here, so, and some of the members were going off playing golf as well. I think I'm right in that show, am I?
Yeah.
And
there's a big do on here.
Yeah. So
he was 50 years here as well.
And he was 50 years here at the same day as well, exactly. So Dad was on the first tee, waving all the players off and giving them the old tip, as he always did. Next thing, one of the members comes running out. Christy, there's a phone call for you. And Dad, stop. I'm here. No, Christy, no, you need to take this phone call. Who is it? It's Jack Nicklaus.
Hmm.
Tell Jack I'll ring him back in 5 minutes. So this was, but no, they got on great together. Like, they played in the opening of Mount Juliet together.
Yeah.
They always talked fondly of each other. They had many a good battle, but yeah, no, for that, Jack Nicklaus was the world number one.
And for you, for the family, to have someone like Christy Senior as part of it, like, you must meet people all the time who have memories of him. It must be almost a daily thing where, in some respect, someone says something about your dad to you. Or has it been like that? Or, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating.
No, oh Jesus, no, you're not. No, I tell you, like, okay, first of all, we thought he was bulletproof until that sad day when he went upstairs, and we all loved him so much, and and he was still so strong, but it's sad he's gone.
Mm.
But since then, I have to say, first of all, the members of Royal Dublin have been fantastic to the family, and we all appreciate it. And coming down here and playing golf here, and all over Ireland, and over in Portugal and Spain, where they have been as well, and the amount of people that, when they find out who I am, come up and just tell their story.
Mm.
And it's fantastic. It's brilliant to hear, but it's every time, and it makes you feel so proud. And it puts a smile on your face when you have maybe that 5 minutes when you're thinking of him or that. But it's brilliant now. It's so much pride.
Mm, yeah, all I can the time. So yeah.
Sadly missed, but so much pride.
Yeah, and I guess final word to you then, Joe. Your any point you want to make, or about his legacy, or about what he meant to Irish golf? Or
I think he paved the way for the Padraig Harringtons and Darren Clarks and McDowell and Rory now. Which I think he certainly put golf on the Irish map. He put Irish golf on the world map as well. You know, that he was a fantastic man. Like, I mean, like, we loved him off the golf course. I mean, it was just, it was more than, you know, he was like the grandfather of everybody as well. You know, like, he was just, he was a special man. Like, he was just very warm, you know, welcoming and all that sort of thing. Tough man as well. But I mean, he was much loved.
Mm.
Yeah, that's, again, the best I can say about him, you know, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we'll
leave all it. I'm sitting there thinking is, I wish there was more YouTube clips on.
I know, it's a pity there's not more footage. You never managed to rustle up more footage anywhere, or it hasn't emerged. Someone doesn't have it sitting in their attic somewhere, do they?
Well, I have a little something that I'm keeping totally for the family. And
of him hitting balls.
Of him hitting balls, and there was a little compilation done. I helped out a person one day, and so I says, I'll do that for you if you do that for me.
Right.
So we have a little something, but in time it'll come out, and when I do it, I promise you, I'll send one over to you.
Yeah, I'd love to have a look at it, yeah, because my God, the swing was just all natural, of course.
Absolutely. Just easy. Not a day's practice,
yeah,
nothing.
Yeah.
get out and do what I told you to do.
Oh, listen, okay, let's never talk about my golf,
then
my
you'll
God.
Be fine. You'll
but
be
what fine. I just one last word, I used to laugh, but I played a lot of golf with him as well. Again, it was his latter years. And I used to love his idea on things that someone might say to him, you know, or a good player, that this is, you know, you did this, and that's why you hit that bad shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out playing and I did a lot of bad shots, and he'd say to me, oh no, Joe, you're doing this. And I'd say, oh, sorry, and I wouldn't do it for 5 or 6 holes, and then it would come back up again then on the back nine somewhere. And he'd look at me and he'd say, why did you do that? I told you not to do it.
Yeah.
And I'd be thinking, oh, I didn't do it intentionally. But he'd look at you as if, like, I told you to stop doing it, so just stop doing it,
it's,
you know.
It's like, it's like the great football player trying to be a manager
and not
understanding why Joe can't.
How come you're not as good as me?
You know?
I said, no.
Because a few people have said he had a great eye. You know, some great players, especially the field players, might know how they're doing what they do. It just kind of happens, and then they mightn't be able to teach others. It seems he had a really good eye. Like, I know you're saying he wasn't technical, Christy, but it seems he did have a really good technical understanding of, well, you're doing this or you're not turning. He seemed to be able to pick out the root cause of your problem quite well.
He actually said it a few times, that a young guy coming out on tour, or a top amateur, and he'd often say, well, I think if he turned pro, he won't necessarily make it, but he will. And the guy who he reckoned would might have lost in a South of Ireland final to the guy who he thinks won't make it.
Interesting.
And in years to come, you know, it has happened. Like,
Harrington wins 3 majors.
Yeah, and he lost to David Higgins in 2 finals of the South, and then the close out in Portmarnock in back to back weeks.
But Christy thought Harrington over.
Oh, no, sorry, I don't mean that. Oh, yeah. But I'm just saying, he'd say that about other players, okay. You know. No, that was just another example. I mean, it wasn't even him that said that, but he'd say things like, so they'd say, this is the next great hope, and he might see a weakness or see something. Not necessarily, maybe, but, you know, and...
You'd wonder how he learned it all.
But it's unbelievable.
Like how did he...
Unbelievable.
You know, I'm watching YouTube videos or getting lessons. Did he have a coach when he was a pro?
When he was young, he did.
But, like, when he was in his 30s, 40s, would he have had a coach?
Oh, Jesus, no.
So how did he figure it all out or keep it together? And there's no Butch Harmon around then?
No, because like, he worked on his own swing. He got a swing. Bob Wallace taught him down in Galway when he was first starting off. Then he went, okay, right, and I'm going to perfect this. That was Dad's idea. That's why he went out and hit so many balls. Mm. He practiced morning, noon, and night. People don't realise. They said he was natural. That's why I said earlier on, no, he hated that, because he worked very hard on his swing.
So he could fix his own swing.
So he knew, okay, if I do that, I'm going to hit it right. If I do that, I'm going to hit it left. He said to me when we were much younger, okay, when you go out and practice, he says, don't be going out like everyone and hitting two buckets of balls. He says, go out and get 40 golf balls. Step away after every shot. Hit one high, hit one low, hit one left, hit one right. Walk away. Come back in again, repeat it. And that's the cycle of learning every shot.
That's how he practiced.
Totally. And I watched him many a time.
Yeah. It's amazing, really. I mean, I appreciate he was taught the basics and then almost just grooved it in himself, so he knew his own body so well and what he was doing inside out to a point that he wouldn't have had a coach, you know.
Wasn't Nicholas the same?
Well, he'd go and see, what was your man's name, once a year?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Nicholas learnt the fundamentals when he was young. His dad taught him an awful lot.
Yeah.
And he's Ravino, another guy.
Yeah.
So, in short, to sign off, Christy, again, because that's kind of gold for the golf nuts who listen to the podcast, take it away. And then you're pulling down with the left hand. And did he want the left hand bowed, or what did he tell you?
No, not bowed. But he was a firm believer that your left hand is the controlling hand when you start the downswing.
For the downswing.
Okay. As he had a beautiful turn, so he turned up to the top of the backswing. Then he broke his wrist. Then at the start of the downswing, he pulled the butt of the club, as he called it. Pull that butt. Pull it down.
Okay.
And then your right hand's going to come in, and you turn over with your right hand as you turn your body through the shot. And as I pointed out to you earlier on, get that belt buckle facing your target. Mm. It makes a difference.
Mm. Okay, so
pulling the church bell, isn't it?
Yeah. Take it away, break the wrists, not straight away though, and then left hand down.
You do, by the way, everyone realise that Joe here is interviewing, but also studying golf.
I think that's fascinating, because actually what he would have said to you is as close as we can get to being inside his head,
to being taught by Christy Senior,
to being inside his head during his golf swing. If that's what he's telling you, then we can probably guess that at some point that's what he's thinking himself. It's a glimpse into his head.
Without a doubt. Okay, right, as he said to me, I was always a slasher at the ball. When he always says, try and swing it slow on your backswing. Swing it as slow as you can on the way back. You don't hit anything on the backswing. And once you get up the top, well, then it said, let fly at it.
Okay.
But keep it slow going back, as long as you have control of that club. And if you make a proper turn through it, the ball will go out at where you're aiming.
Mm.
As I said, like, he wasn't technical, but it was aim, grip, stance.
Mm. And when you say you were a slasher, does that mean you were like in a hurry to...
Yeah, quick. So he says, slow down, young man.
Okay. That's what he'd say to you.
And he'd say that to everyone because of his age.
Yeah.
But it was funny, but that was it. Okay. Even at 90 years of age, Joe and myself were out playing golf. And he'd find out, okay, what time we're playing.
Mm.
So we'd come down the second road in Royal Dublin. And he'd park the car, come over to the tee to us. And he'd have a look and see how you're swinging it. And if we were lucky enough, he'd say, here, give me that club. And he'd hit it 220,
really?
Straight up the middle of the fairway, 230 at 90 years of age.
Was he just hands then, almost?
Oh, he still had a turn. Yeah, he still had a turn.
That was pressure. Him standing beside you.
So
that was brilliant.
So not so quick, young man. That rings through your head still, probably, on a golf course.
Yeah, totally. Especially you know, if you're getting into a pressure situation or that, it's the classic thing, right, okay, slow it down, slow it down. And then tunnel vision. He was mad into that, as I'm sure you've heard earlier on, with people. Like, when Dan went on a golf course, he just saw, he says, get that tunnel vision. You don't see anyone. He says, you shouldn't be able to recognise anyone. Right. Or if you do, keep away from them. Just you. It's you in that tunnel. It was brilliant.
It's great to get those little insights. That they're like his private almost memos to himself.
You know, but like they were brilliant. Like he was brilliant. But, you know, sadly, he's up there looking down at us all now, but we miss him.
Listen, lads, thanks very much. Pleasure.
Okay. Thanks, lads.
There you are, Christy Jr. and nephew Joe N. right there. So finally, we'll bring you Christy Sr.'s friends. And we are met by the Royal Dublin crew themselves. We have here Cecil Roden, we have Barry Dillon, we have Dennis Murphy and Sean Kelly, who all at one time or another had spent plenty of time with Christy on the fairways of Royal Dublin. And they were good enough to come along and give us some memories to finish.
It took a while to get used to playing with him, because you tended to watch what he was doing and forget about your own game. But when you got used to being in his presence on the golf course, you learned that you had to concentrate on your own game or you were going to lose the money.
Yeah. And so he played you for money. Would he give you tips, or was it, what kind of atmosphere was it?
It was lovely. It was a very friendly atmosphere. We never played for huge money. And he would help you. He would certainly help you, yes. He was very observant, and he'd see where you were making mistakes, and he'd be very, very generous in his help, yes.
Was he competitive, though?
Very.
Go on, tell us how.
Well, he got me down to 8 handicap, and he would ring me at home, and he'd say, I have a couple of visitors coming who need to be plucked, and he'd say, are you free today? And I'd come down, and I'd say, what are you playing for? Don't you worry about that, he'd say. You're playing for a fiver. He wouldn't tell you how much he was playing for in case you didn't operate. But they really didn't have much chance against him out here, you know.
Well, was it strange? Like, I mean, clearly, if you got down to 8, you were a good golfer in your own right. But was it weird or difficult playing with a guy as talented as Christy? Because then your game, or our games, just could never measure up.
Well, funnily enough, I always felt I learned more through playing with him than I did during lessons. Because you learnt a bit about course management, and you saw the things he did, and you tried to emulate him, you know. So that was one of the reasons why I got my handicap down. But I enjoyed his company very much over a long period of time, and he was very helpful to me. I used to come down here in the mornings, and I'd go down to the second little practice ground, and he'd just stroll up, and we'd have an unofficial lesson. He'd have me pitching balls up and down and all the rest of it, you know. It was amazing the difference you could make to your ability in a very short period of time. And he was great company.
On that, remember I was in the garden one time practicing, trying to sort out my swing. And Christy used to play a few holes practicing for the seniors championship at that time. And I was making a mess of this session. And suddenly he was standing beside me and he said, what's gone wrong with your swing? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I was just playing the 15th there, and I saw you over from the tee, and I couldn't go on because you're making an awful hames of that. So I was thinking to myself, would Watson or Nicklaus or one of these greats, as great as he was, do something like that for their members, walk over maybe 200 yards from a tee? It was just amazing. He spent about a half an hour there trying to sort me out. So it was never in any way that he would say do this or do that, although he would like you to swing like he did, which you knew you couldn't. But that was just the way he was. He was able to do that.
Yeah, he wouldn't be over technical on the lessons or what he'd tell you. Like, he just believed that everybody should be able to play the game with the same ease that he played it. So he'd only tell you small tips or whatever, but he believed that everybody should be able to play it at that level. And you just automatically improved, as you were saying, Cecil, there, when you played with him, because you just watched his swing, and his swing was so fluid and smooth, it was just brilliant.
Sean Kelly, you're sitting there listening away, quietly smiling, and I'm wondering, what have you got to say?
Well, I suppose after the over the last few years, I got very, very friendly with Christy, indeed with Dennis Murphy. up in his house many, many times watching golf. But the one thing I remember about him when I was honorary secretary here, he would come down in the mornings and come into the office and he'd have a cup of coffee with me. Now, Louise in the office would put a little drop of something in his coffee.
Milk.
Milk, exactly. And then he would ask me, who's out on the golf course today? And I'd go off and check and I'd say, there's four Swedes, three Germans and eight Americans. And he'd say, grand, I'm off now. And he'd go down the course to the practice ground and he would meet every one of them coming up. And what amazed me was, we kind of think that he was in a different era. It was amazing the number of people that actually knew him. You know, they'd come in and say, we met Christy. And he was terrific that way. He'd be on the first tee helping people.
We don't live our life looking into the rearview mirror.
No.
And that's fine. And happiness comes from being able to accept the life you've led as being the one you have. But at the same time, did he ever give you, or any of you, an inclination that, you know what, would have been nice. Would have been nice to have my talent and my hard work rewarded with a major.
Never to me, anyway. I think he was very, very happy in his own way. He lived up in Clontarf with Mary. And to me, he had a very, very happy life. And I don't think he had any regrets, to be honest with you. Maybe in his own mind, he might sit down sometime and think about it, but he certainly never mentioned it to me.
Mm. In terms of his achievements, he won the first four-figure sum. He won the first five-figure sum. And he won the first six-figure sum. Mm. So I wouldn't say he was greedy, but he achieved an awful lot of success outside of majors, which seemed to satisfy him. When he played the major, he nearly won, and he was last out, and he was leading the tournament. Dave Thomas was in front of him. Dave Thomas lost four holes in front of him, and he appealed to the stewards, or the referee, to ask Thomas to let them through. And the referee said, he's won four British Opens, what do you mean, young man? And Christy had to hang back, and he got it. He didn't win it, but he always regretted that he felt he was the victim of sportsmanship or bad sportsmanship in that.
To finish in a positive, are there any fond stories you have? If people say to you, give us a Christy story, is there any one that anyone wants to tell?
At the opening of Mount Juliet, Christy played Jack Nicklaus. And there was a clinic beforehand, and Christy was...
When was this, Dennis?
The opening of Mount Juliet was about 1985, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, around that time. But it was a big match, and Christy... The sons would tell you that the minute he knew he was playing, he changed his whole method and went practicing madly. But anyway...
Because he really respected Nicklaus.
He admired Nicklaus. Okay. But they had a clinic, and Christy's clinic was he would start at a wedge and go back, and he'd create a kind of a rivet in the ground about that length and about that deep. And his last shot was always, he'd put a ball down and he'd tap it down with the driver. And then he'd hit it 200 yards down the middle of the fairway from this, and talk about people giving out about bad lies in the golf course. So after doing this, and a big round of applause, he turned to Jack and he said, do you want to have a go at that, Jack? And Jack said, Christy, you do your tricks and I'll do mine.
Did they have a good relationship?
They did, yeah. They played here in the match. And they really had a good relationship, yeah. He admired them. And there's a film, a photograph there of Jack came back to the club to sympathise with the club and the loss of Christy after he died. Yeah, he did, really.
When was that?
That was last year, wasn't it? The picture's there. It's beside the door there just as you come into the Christy room.
So did Jack just call back for an afternoon?
He was somewhere in the country, and he got in touch with the club, came back and met the captain to sympathise.
It's a touch of class, isn't it?
Touch of class, yes, indeed. Yeah. The other main thing about it, he was the only one whose funeral cortege went right through the course. The only time it's ever happened, and probably the only time it ever will happen. And it was an amazing sight, with the whole funeral driving through the golf course in memory and in respect to the man.
Yeah, there you are. Memories from Cecil Roden, Barry Dillon, Dennis Murphy, Sean Kelly. So that's us done. Thanks everybody for downloading. You should send in any memories of Christy that you want to fire into us to golfweeklyotb@golfweeklyotb on Twitter, and we'll get to them next week when normal service resumes.
Thanks again to Christy's family. They made us feel so welcome. Royal Dublin was just a treat. It was a fantastic day. I mean, one of the really enjoyable days doing the pod. So special thanks to Conor Darcy for the invite out and to Christy Jr. Really enjoyed the round, and I'm sure we'll see them again at some stage. That's us done for this week. Good luck.